The Law.
Murphy's Law Podcast. Your host, Ian Murphy.
And I'm just like, this is hard for him to hold back.
So much I want to share.
Remove all the emotion from all of this stuff.
And they never wanted this to happen to the citizens again.
We never stop growing as an individual. Right.
All right. Welcome to this week's episode of Murphy's Law Podcast. I'm your host, Ian Murphy. With me is my good buddy, Chris Kuhn. Thanks for joining me as always.
My pleasure.
Kind of just the regular co-host at this point, my man.
Yeah, kind of enjoying it. So yeah, it's been kind of fun. I mean, it's been a lot of fun just breaking down everything we're going through into layman's terms.
So we are in a little bit different venue. So we're down in the restaurant today. We kind of jokingly call this Studio B, Studio Pig. A little bit different setup down here. We thought we'd give it a try just to see a little more casual atmosphere here. We're all about casual.
Well, and it'd be kind of fun to, you know, get some involvement from the crowd. When we have one.
Yeah. So one of the things we wanted to discuss today was the recent brief that was filed this last week. Some attorneys were hired by the Michigan Senate and the Michigan House of Representatives, and they filed what's called an amicus curiae brief. I had no idea what it was. I don't know about you.
No. I mean, we know briefs are filed all the time.
I only play an attorney on TV, not in real life. So I had to look it up to figure out what amicus curiae meant. And it literally, Latin means friend of the court. Someone who is not party to a case assists a court by offering information, expertise, or insight that has bearing on the issues in the case.
Which makes sense when it comes to what we know as friend of the court, which is not really a friend of many guys.
I don't think it's really a friend of anybody. Yeah, no. I mean, if you have kids or ever had to go through a divorce with kids, that's they're not
a
friend of the court.
No friend.
So this is what they've done. The Michigan Senate, the Michigan House of Representatives have filed a friend of the court brief, basically requesting that the state Supreme Court not take up the Department of Health and Human Services application for leave to appeal. That's a mouthful. But basically what they're saying is they've laid out a couple of points in their brief as a reason why the Supreme Court of Michigan shouldn't hear this appeal.
And this is really, I mean, let's be real, this is a huge deal. The House and the Senate don't typically weigh into a lawsuit, but they came across this and like, no. They see what the Health Department, the Health and Human Services Department is doing. And they're like, no, this can't stand.
I didn't know there really was such a thing. And again, why would I? I mean, I'm in the restaurant business, so I would never know of such things. But I got this motion to add these two law firms onto the appeal and this motion. And I sent a text message. I'm like, what does this mean to our attorney? He's like, is the state Supreme Court going to hear it? Like, does this mean that they're going to hear it or what? And he calls me right up and explains to me exactly what's going on. He says, well, this is great news. So they are basically lobbying the state Supreme Court on our behalf and pointing out a couple of things to the Supreme Court saying you should not take this. And we'll break it down a little bit for those of us that don't read Latin on a regular basis or read any of this lawyer stuff on a regular basis.
Well, and as a recap, I mean, Judge Hunter gave a ruling, which, by the way, the state asked for a ruling from the court. Didn't like the decision. Immediately went to the Court of Appeals when they had already asked Judge Hunter to reconsider his decision, as well as grant a stay. But then the next day, immediately skipped to the Michigan Supreme Court.
Yep.
So jumped from Judge Hunter, Court of Appeals, Supreme Court in a matter of 2 days.
And we really haven't discussed much about their reasonings for appeal. The real reason for that is because the reasoning for their appeals now are ridiculous, honestly. So it really is not worth our time to try and argue. They've thrown a bunch of precedents at this saying there's a million different reasons why we shouldn't take this up, but they don't address either of the central issues that they stipulated to Judge Hunter ruling on.
The in re questions.
Yeah.
I mean, it ultimately comes down to they didn't like the judge's answer, and they're trying to cry to daddy to reconsider.
Yeah. So we'll go through real quick exactly what it is that the amicus curiae brief that the Senate and the House of Representatives law firms have filed. And real quick, the three main points, and we'll break them down a little bit more here in a second, but the three main points are, the first one is that the Court of Appeals should hear this first. So this was in district court here in Otsego County. The next level would be the Court of Appeals. And then the next level above that would be
Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court. And then you go outside, you go to federal court, yep. Blah, blah, blah.
Circuit Court, Court of Appeals, Supreme Court.
So then number two, they state the department has not preserved the central issue. And what that means is they basically have not brought forward, even in their arguments in the appeal, they haven't carried those arguments through to the appeal, basically because they didn't argue against them in the appeal. Again, we'll break that down a little bit more. And then the third one is it would be inappropriate for the health department to use a change in the makeup, the constitution of the court as it relates to conservative judges and liberal judges. It was 4-3 last October, October 2020, when in recertified questions was ruled. Now that court has flipped 4-3 liberal to conservative. So we've always felt that they would love to be able to relitigate in recertified questions. They can't now because it's been the 1945 Emergency Powers of the Governor Act is no longer a law on the books.
But it makes sense, if you think about the way they're looking at it, to go in front of a liberal court.
Yeah, yeah, and that's exactly what they want. So we're going to break this down here, these three points here, in just a minute. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Murphy's Law Podcast. I'm your host, Ian Murphy. With me, Chris Kuhn, as always. I did want to mention really quick before we get back into this, we did a Lego competition, a guessing competition for our mural that we have on the wall here in a restaurant. So some friends of ours, Tim and Zach Kroll, that were on Lego Mega Masters, Lego Masters.
On Fox, yeah.
On Fox, Season 2. Right here from our hometown, Gaylord. They've got a wonderful store right next to the restaurant here called Alpine Brick Exchange. And when they were, actually before they were on the show, they couldn't tell us a whole lot. They had non-disclosure agreements that they couldn't tell us exactly what was going on. But they had offered to make us a 5x5 mural of our logo that's now hanging here in the restaurant. And they were gracious enough to come in for the first couple of episodes on Fox, and we did a watch party here, and they signed it and everything. Really great guys, great store, go check it out. So what we did is we held a competition to guess how many Lego pieces were in that 5-foot by 5-foot mural.
To which I was amazed by the answer.
It's incredible. So we have a certified plaque and everything that Tim and Zach will sign that have the official number. So lots of numbers were thrown out, but the closest answer... What was your guess?
My guess would have been 10,000. I know it was way off because I already know the answer.
So the correct answer for the most Lego pieces was 20,585 pieces that are in that mural hanging here in the restaurant. Ashley Bergman guessed 20,173. So very close, 412. And, pieces know, off. That's very impressive. Good job, Ashley.
It's really impressive, and just to think that they put that much time into that.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have thought.
We've got some neat videos of them putting that together, time-lapse videos and everything. Very artistic, something I could never do.
No, never.
And so, the fact that, actually, the really impressive part is that they built it in a module. So we reassembled it together and put it on the wall. So it wasn't just trucked here in a 5x5 thing. They built it in modules so it could get put back together.
And if you haven't seen it before, next time you're in here, come check it out. Now that you know there's over 20,000 pieces in this thing,
yeah,
that's impressive.
So, Ashley, we have your information. We're going to reach out. We've got a gift card for the Iron Pig, and Tim and Zach have thrown in a gift card for Alpine Brick Exchange. If you get a chance, go check them out. They do some really neat stuff over in that store there. come on by, have a sandwich, go visit their store. Really cool setup that they've got going over there. So anyway, so let's move on to kind of why we're here, really. Let's break down these couple of points that this amicus brief is explaining. And again, this is just a brief in support of us, basically. Really what they're saying is that the Supreme Court should not take up the application for appeal based on three things. The first one being that the Court of Appeals should hear this case first. In the order of things, this is one that everybody should be able to wrap their brain around pretty simply. There's good reason for the lower courts to look at these, rule on them, go through the normal process. I don't think we need to spend a whole lot of time talking about that. No, everybody should have a pretty good grasp of
it. And it ultimately comes down to, like, the House and the Senate. In the opening of Exhibit A in the brief, comes right out and says, the House of Representatives and the Senate together comprise the sole lawmaking body for the state of Michigan. This proceeding raises issues of vital importance to that exclusive power to legislate, and no party is more interested in these issues than Michigan's first branch of government, the legislature.
Yeah. I mean, that's the crux of the whole case, right? I mean, we're talking about the separation of co-equal branches of government, and we've said from the beginning that the health department has too broad a power, especially for unelected officials with virtually no consequence.
No, in the three branches, I mean, obviously we've got the judicial weighing in now, legislative finally throwing the hat in the ring, and oddly enough, the executive branch has kind of been absent since it started.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we've often talked behind the scenes about, you know, the reasons why a lot of people can speculate clearly there's an election coming up. You know, things are starting to turn as far as case counts and mask mandate rescissions.
And public opinion.
And clearly public opinion. We've been here doing this going on a year and 3 months, basically 4 months, something like that.
Going back to the first day with wrapping paper on the windows.
We're excited to see more people joining the fight. You know, the truckers, what's going on with all of that and some of those mandates and stuff. So we stand behind those guys, gals, 110%. It's nice to see the parents supporting their kids that don't feel comfortable in schools with the masks and the mask mandate, because these are all built on 2253 that we challenged in court last year.
Well, and you know, we've said all along that largely people feel the same way as what we do. They just weren't to that point where they're ready to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And now as the numbers change, quote unquote, follow the science, it's starting to turn in, I guess, for lack of a better term, our favor. And people are starting to stand up.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm curious to see how this pans out, because ultimately, where's the state going to go?
Yeah. They don't really have anywhere to go. And I feel like that's why they're clinging to this so hard. And we've talked about this before, but it's incredibly difficult for some of these people in these positions to admit when they're wrong or they've done, you know, gone a little bit overboard on some of these things. And dialing back for them is a very difficult thing for somebody that has grasped so much power to give that up.
Well, they were so convinced that they were right. I mean, and even just as recently as yesterday, the CDC revised their mask guidelines or recommendations.
Yeah.
To where now they're a thing of the past.
Yeah.
You know, it's more proof they don't work. They haven't, but, you know, they've been so convinced to hang on to power. Yeah, getting there.
We're getting there. You know, the CDC or the Johns Hopkins study we've talked about a couple of times, you know, that's further proof. You know,
yeah.
We're
62 pages.
Yeah. So the Court of Appeals ruling first, you know, that's an easy one. Right, out of the gate, that in and of itself should be an excuse for the state Supreme Court to not hear it. Let the lower court take up the application if they feel it necessary. Because they don't have to either.
No, and that's been the key problem all along, is they have not followed due process. I mean, going way back to the first challenge, the state has not followed due process. And in this case, they didn't like Hunter's decision, even though they asked for a decision, so they wanted to leapfrog all the way to the Supreme Court. It just doesn't work that way.
So that's their first argument right there. Let's see. There's a lot of stuff in here. Precedents basically telling the court, Court of Appeals needs to rule first, and there's a lot of advantages to that. We don't need to delve into a whole lot of that stuff. The second one is the department has not preserved the central issue it wants the court to review.
No, which is them challenging the INRI certified questions.
Yep.
Which they haven't discussed any further other than they haven't addressed it other than not addressing it.
So they basically didn't brief it. They put a footnote in their briefing, and then in the oral arguments in the appeal hearing before Judge Hunter, they made reference to the footnote in the brief. They didn't offer any oral argument other than to stand on their objections in the motion.
No, they pretty much stood mute. And as a matter of fact, they went so far as to say that, you know, Judge Hunter acted outside of his authority.
I find this pretty interesting. Here it is basically saying that the footnote says no need for the court to consider whether INRI certified questions was rightly decided. The department noted INRI certified questions was wrongly decided for nothing more than preservation purposes, which I find kind of interesting because here they are petitioning the Supreme Court again. Now, again, it's slightly different makeup, but it's tough to come back and ask a court 16 months later to basically relook and have another look at something they just decided.
And, you know, I know you were on obviously watching, and for those of us that watched, the health department or the state was very condescending in that hearing.
Yeah.
With Judge Hunter. Very.
That's a whole other set of issues that's interesting to see. We're going to take a really quick break, probably listen to a commercial from none other than the Iron Pig. Imagine that. So we'll be right back. Murphy's Law Podcast.
Iron Pig Smokehouse in downtown Gaylord features low and slow barbecue beef brisket, pulled pork, and chicken. Order a delicious burger, pizza, tacos, and more at the Iron Pig Smokehouse. Open for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Dine in, take out. Delivery available at ironpigsmoke.com.
All right, thanks for joining us, Murphy's Law Podcast. Chris Kuhn with me. So we've been going over a couple of these things that the amicus brief that the Senate and House of Representatives filed with the Supreme Court this last week, and we're down to the third and final point that they make, basically asking the court to not take up the application and more or less allowing the Court of Appeals, the lower court in this case, to, if anything, at least consider that application first.
Yeah, at least hear the case and make a ruling on it.
And a lot of people don't understand, but it is just an application. It's a request. So the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court are not obligated to take up the appeal whatsoever. In our opinion, they shouldn't because they haven't made their case. When that does happen, the ruling stands. It's done. There's no more appeals. They can't come back and say anything else. We're done. We move on. And then we go to most likely the Court of Claims or something like that. And then we try and go back and get, you know, the other fines that we paid earlier in the year. You know, I've got a contempt of court on my personal record from Eaton County or, I think it's Ingham yeah. County. Ingham County, sorry.
Ingham.
Eaton, I think, is maybe next door. Anyways, so the third and final point that these two law firms are making on behalf of the Michigan Senate and House of Representatives is that it is inappropriate for the health department to use a change in this court's composition as a change as to change the outcome of the case. The way that this one is explained to me, so this kind of goes back to relitigating something that was just decided not too long ago. 16 months ago, October 2020 was when the Michigan Supreme Court ruled INRI certified questions, Carl the Barber's case, and the emergency powers of the governor, the 1945 Act, unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. We used a lot of that non-delegation doctrine argument in our case. The health department and the state feels that INRI certified questions sort of changed the definition of non-delegation doctrine. And we've talked about this, and it actually doesn't. It more or less reaffirms and actually gives it further definition. This case, the way it was explained, I'm sorry, this last point, the way it's explained to me in the easiest of terms is to think about Roe v. Wade.
good point.
50 some years ago now, Roe v. Wade and the abortion. So there were cases that were trying to overturn that ruling, that Supreme Court ruling, immediately.
Well, and I think it's important to point out again, too, that keep in mind, they're beating a dead horse because this whole thing is based on that three-paragraph MCL.
Yeah.
Most importantly, the first paragraph.
Less than one page.
Yeah, less than one page.
So the argument has always been, and I think there's actually even a Latin term in law for it. I don't know it. I'm not smart enough to know it. I think it's buried in here somewhere, but they are basically saying that it's improper for a court to try and relitigate something so soon after it has been decided.
Well, and they came right out and said that nearly 150 years ago, this court unanimously admonished that a hearing should not be ordered on the ground merely that a change of the members of the bench has either taken place
or is about to occur. Yeah.
I mean, to try to fall back on that as a last resort is that, okay, now Supreme Court's back in our favor. Let's try again.
Yeah. And the time. You know, the makeup is one thing. The time is another thing. With regards to, and that why Roe v. Wade was brought to my attention, is because now there is at least, whether you agree or disagree, that's not the point. It's the time, and now there is a body of evidence to work from to consider now potentially revamping that. Again, whether you agree, we're not here to talk about that, but it is how that procedure works with looking at a constitutional argument before the Supreme Court, whether it's the federal Supreme Court or a state Supreme Court, it is the same. So they're saying 16 months after this non-delegation doctrine ruling came out, it would be improper for them to try and relitigate that more or less again.
Yeah, the timing is way too convenient.
So they lay out some really good reasons here, pretty simple, that you and I can understand, let alone the folks, these seven people at the state Supreme Court whose job it is to look at these applications. And I'll read the conclusion really quick. There is no compelling reason to circumvent the typical process of allowing the Court of Appeals to consider the issues presented in the ordinary course. To the contrary, the department's failure to preserve the issue presented below, the fact that no lower court has weighed in on that issue, and the department's apparent last-minute decision to bet on this court's recent change in composition for a change in result, all counsel the opposite. The department's bypass application should be denied. We could have boiled this episode really down into that conclusion right there, because it pretty much states it right there. We're hoping that they look at this and rightfully decide that they shouldn't be taking this up. Hopefully, the Court of Appeals also looks at this amicus brief. Whether or not they file additional amici brief, plural, with the Court of Appeals, we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah, we'll see if they actually go back down, or is it going to disappear? Again, as the
Judge
science.
Hunter's ruling was brilliant. And we are still getting comments from lawyers that are saying that this is one of the most well-written decisions with regards to non-delegation doctrine. Regardless if in recertified questions was talked about 16 months ago or not, he got it right.
He did. Really, the way he summarized the events and the way everything went down.
Yeah,
was spot on.
You know, and he took the emotion out of it too. We've tried to say that a long time, is that you got to remove the emotion from the emergency situation of, you know, COVID and everything that was happening, and whether you're for masks, against masks, for vaccine.
Which,
against
by the
vaccines,
way, again, we don't care.
I don't care.
Do what you want to do.
It's your choice. That's where we're leaving it at. That's what we've said from the beginning. That and due process is a pretty important thing. And there's a lot that they point out in this that is related to due process.
Truly, and that's what it all ultimately comes down to.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens with this as we go forward. We do expect, and my understanding is that more groups may jump on board and file amicus briefs as well.
Well, oh, by the way, there's another recent win, and we forgot to talk about Kalamazoo.
Oh, yeah.
Another big win.
What's the school district down there? Is it Monroe?
Was it Comstock?
Comstock. Yep. So let me see if I can pull that up really quick. Comstock Schools.
Kudos, Dave. Another win.
Yep. So our attorney had a lawsuit going down in the Kalamazoo area. Pardon me while I try and pull this up. The judge down there, let me get the timing on this. Wednesday, I believe, they put out a request for a temporary restraining order.
And less than 24 hours later.
And less than 24 hours later, the judge issued a temporary restraining order against the school system down there for the mask mandate. Basically removing the masks, as the health department did up here recently with the K-12 mask rescission as well.
Weird. It just went away.
Went away.
Good job, Dave.
So this is what's big about this one is, so I think he's got a number of these lawsuits and at least a dozen different plaintiffs, if you will. This one is a big deal because this is the first one that is being ruled on with regards to non-delegation doctrine. They have brought them up in all of these cases because they're all built on 2253, which has now been ruled unconstitutional by Judge Hunter.
Yep.
So finally, they have come around and said on the school mask mandates, it's a little bit different because they have some school code law that they're also using alongside the 2253. So the 2253 gives them the reason to use the school code in this case. So we've taken one of their legs out by getting rid of the health code.
Well, another big win was the resignation of our health officer.
Yeah. Yeah, if we had more time, maybe we'll make some more time to talk about that one. But anyway, so this we'll see what happens with this as we move forward. We'll always keep you updated. Chris and I will bring you the latest updates. We'll try and get our attorney back on here pretty soon, too, to give us the official lawyerly version of all of this. But thanks for tuning in, as always. Murphy's Law Podcast. For Chris Kuhn, I'm Ian Murphy. Be sure to subscribe, check us out, like our page, all that fun stuff. Instagram, YouTube. Where else are we at?
Spotify.
TikTok, Spotify. Who knows? We're everywhere. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you soon.
All right. Welcome to a special bonus edition of Murphy's Law Podcast. We're going to call this a Bye Feliza edition.
Definitely a bonus episode.
So we decided to have a little conversation about a local recent happening with our health department conglomerate.
Dearly beloved.
Northwest Michigan Health Department. I never get it right.
I think you got it right. Plus two.
Benzene. Yeah, anyways. and it's not uncommon. You know, we've got four counties, six, you know, if you count the other two that they have some affiliation with.
Yep.
We decided to have a little conversation about this because it does kind of have something to do with the child mask mandates. There are several jurisdictions around the state that have had some school districts, health departments, combinations of. In our jurisdiction up here, August is when they...
Yeah, in August, because our school district had came out with a great plan, which was wear a mask or don't. If you want to wear a mask, we'll provide sterile classrooms, we'll sanitize them. And then the Wicked Witch of the West decided that wasn't good enough and implemented the mask mandate for everybody, all kids in school.
And the school board had meetings here in town, at least our local school board. I can't say much for the other school districts represented in the health department. Again, it's four counties plus. Mm-hmm. But our local Gaylord Community Schools, they had a plan of choice. They were given choices to be in classroom, out of classroom, mask, no mask, you know, whatever it is that you felt most comfortable with your children. That was what they were giving you the opportunity.
Which is, again, what we're in support of.
And then was it just before...
It was a Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock.
Is it Labor Day? Which one's the one in the fall? Was the holiday? So it was Labor Day. So it was just before Labor Day, right?
Yeah, it was like 5 o'clock on a Friday.
So that they dropped the hammer on this mask mandate. So they'd gone through all this effort to come up with this plan of choice, and everybody had agreed on for the most part.
Yeah, and again, for our district, I thought it was a great idea.
I think everybody was comfortable with it, and then sort of unilaterally the health department came in and decided to institute a K-12 mask mandate.
Well, and not the health department. Let's be clear here. One person, with the help of her chief medical officer.
Yeah.
Lisa Peacock.
Yeah, Josh Meyerson, yeah. Right? I think, yeah, okay. We have, you know, the health department does a myriad of things. In my estimation, probably too many, but, you know, I'm a limited government kind of person. But,
yep.
You know, our dealings with the health department mainly include food safety inspections.
And for the most part, the health department does a great job. I mean, we applaud most all the employees and all the things you do. It's just this one thing that we're talking about.
Yeah, there's, you know, I've got some friends that do some pretty awesome stuff with the health department. There's some mental health things that probably should get more attention and could probably use more funding. Unfortunately, the monies that are being spent defending this person's actions in a lawsuit, you know, I would prefer to see those monies going towards more of the mental health programs that they do have. I don't want to get too far off, but
that's really
we're not admonishing the entire health department. We've had a great relationship with them as far as, you know, our food safety inspections with, you know, we have Holly, we've had Rhiannon, Scott K, all good people that they come in here, they do their thing twice a year, no problems. We have water inspections up at our golf course, well inspections, I should say. So they do a lot of good things. So we're not wholly picking on the health department, but you know it's a great example of an administrative body having too much control. And to get back on track, they issued this mask mandate back in August, just before school starts, after a plan of choice was already put in place and agreed upon by everybody. And then they decide that with the looking at their numbers. And I think maybe even at the time, I forget the timing of it now, maybe it had been the start of Omicron or something like that. I don't know. But they used some data to justify the mask on children. And we're not going to talk about the science or the data or the math or any of that crap surrounding any of it, because that doesn't do any good. Again, we're talking about the way that a law was used and implemented and the broad range
abused.
From shutting down restaurants, hardware stores, yep. Barbershops, tanning salons, gymnasiums, and that kind of thing, to putting masks on kids. So, I mean, this is a perfect example of the broad reach that we are talking about when this happens. So, anyways, a lot of consternation has happened locally in our Board of Health. So, most of these, or I think all of these health departments have a Board of Health. By law, they have to have certain employees with certain certifications and licenses and that sort of thing. Ms. Peacock certainly meets those. Dr. Meyerson, I also believe, meets those as well. So what has happened is, and not just in our Board of Health, but lots of school districts, school boards, any public board right now has seen an increase in participation from the public.
Well, and a change of members really quickly, too. I mean, a lot of school boards, people are stepping down, parents, new people coming in.
Yeah.
Because they're tired of it being pushed around.
We got involved in the K-12 mask mandate case mainly because of our non-delegation argument, which is also made in at least 10 of these lawsuits around the state filed with our attorney. Not our case, but other cases that he has also taken to court. We talked about briefly the one of them in one of our previous episodes, segments about the Kalamazoo case that finally got one that broke through.
Yep,
that is one of several, I think maybe even a dozen at this point, of those types of lawsuits. So what's happening is that these boards, these public meetings, parents are coming and voicing their opinions against the mask mandates for kids. Some are in favor. But these officials that county commissioners, there's two commissioners from all four counties, so there's eight, plus a couple of the administrative officials that sit in these board meetings. And our health officer, chief health officer, Lisa Peacock, announced her resignation this last week. And, you know, she's citing a hostile work environment, among many other things, as well as, you know, harassment. Basically, she's just saying that the environment is making it tough for her to do her job.
Yeah, so much so that last week's meeting she didn't even attend because of the quote-unquote fear.
It's interesting to see what is happening in these boards. This board in particular has had two members at least in the last, I think, 30 or 60 days that have changed hands. And, you know, and that's how these things go. As members come and go, commissioners are elected, they are at least elected. Ms. Peacock is not. She's appointed. She's got a contract, which is another part of our issue with it, is here's a person that is basically issuing these mandates, these decrees, based on her own information, and then shares this information through various channels, but refuses to have basically an open dialogue. And that's why most of these parents mainly are upset at these meetings.
Well, and I find it weird too, and I was intrigued to learn the fact that when that position is appointed, when Lisa Peacock was appointed, the same board that appointed her does not have the authority to remove her from said position, which to me is absurd, honestly. I mean, you put somebody in a job, but you can't remove them.
This is what happens when... Well, let's hold on for a second. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back, and we'll finish up that thought. All right, we're back. Thanks for staying with us here through a quick break. We're just talking about a recent resignation from our local health department lead officer, Lisa Peacock. This last week, she announced her resignation. I have not had many dealings with Ms. Peacock, other than seeing her on the other side of the screen in Zoom court.
Zoom camera. It's about the only time you've seen her lately.
Basically making, you know, accusations and reading out our Facebook comments and things of this nature, and basically just, you know, propagating the fear factor through all of these things. It's basically, she is the scare tactic face, if you will, in my opinion, locally, regionally, you know, in the 4+ counties that she covers.
Which, by the way, Lisa, thanks for the advertising for the pig. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it was also interesting to see that this person accepted an award this last summer. She's now resigning. You know, some jokes were made at our expense during that award presentation that we thought were pretty hilarious. She actually didn't take the bait, so I'll kind of give her some props on that one. But
push a button there again. You know it. That pisses me off. Certain people, you know who you are. Ooh.
Yeah, you know, if you're in the newspaper business,
fish wrap,
stick to newspapers and not comic relief. So it's interesting, though, that here's a person that says that she loves her job, but yet she essentially cannot take. And I'm not going to deny that. I'm sure that people were probably harassing her. What level of harassment? I'm not really sure. I could speculate, but I'm going to tell you, her demeanor in these open meetings is just atrocious.
It was smug.
I mean, just mean, just a mean girl, just somebody that doesn't seem like she's open to discussion and trying to get people to understand at least where she's coming from. There is a lot of emotion involved with these things because these parents are seeing their kids going to school upset. They're being bullied. Parents and students that are involved in the lawsuit are also being bullied and also harassed. So we have been bullied. I wouldn't really say bullied. That word's silly to me. Harassed, we've definitely been harassed. Thankfully, most of the harassment has been at a distance, at arm's length. We haven't had any in the store here. You know, we had an issue at one of our other local bars here with a brawl that broke out, but that's neither here nor there. But for the most part, everything has been at an arm's length. But I'll be the first to say that I don't feel bad for Lisa Peacock whatsoever.
Not at all.
Now, I'm not saying that any violent or harassment that she did receive is okay, but I don't feel bad for you, given that you basically unilaterally made these decisions and continue to ignore the commissioners, continue to ignore the public, continue to ignore the parents, all the way until last week when they were one of five in the state that still had a mask mandate. I think it was about five.
It was.
And of course, now they cite the falling date at the numbers and this, that, and the other, and it just now happens.
Yeah, they're claiming it as a win.
Yeah.
Because they did these things, nobody found out.
It flies in the face of a lot of things. And the part that I have the hardest time with throughout this whole thing is this is her job. She was paid throughout all of this. You know, 3,000 restaurants in Michigan were shut down last year, and I certainly don't blame Lisa Peacock for that. But she was certainly toeing that same line.
Well, in the audacity that they also want to recoup legal fees in some of these cases.
Yeah.
It's their own doing.
I think it's a joke.
It's a joke.
It's all OPM and taxpayer money, right, that's being spent on it. But it seems wildly hypocritical for her to be making these comments that she made in her resignation letter, this, that, and the other. And unfortunately, whether Lisa Peacock likes it or not, this is how representative government works. Now, if she's being called names and being shouted at, or if people are visiting her at home, or you know, calling her personal phone numbers and leaving harassing messages, you know, that most of that stuff is not appropriate. But when you get pushback at an open meeting, and you react and you speak, and your tone is a certain way, I don't feel bad when these types of things happen to you because you act this way.
Well, I'm just gonna put it out there. Give your balls a tug. You asked for it.
It's part of the job. If she doesn't like it now, then she should resign. But don't sit here and say that I'm gonna whine and cry about all of this stuff and it's just become a toxic environment. It's a toxic environment because you dumped the toxic waste in the pool, honey. So I'm not really sure. You know, it's like the crying wolf thing, right?
Oh, exactly what it is. I mean, everybody told you, as far as your constituents, what they wanted, and just refused to listen.
And it's worth pointing out that we're not sitting here disputing any of the data or the science or whatever it was that they've been using for the last year and a half, 2 years for this stuff, or she has been using since August for the K-12 mask mandates. But there is plenty of information that other jurisdictions looked at to make different choices. And why they chose to exclude those is beyond me.
And they held so steadfast to it, too. There was no reconsideration. Even when the board begged and pleaded and tried to remove her,
yeah,
there was no reconsideration. It was just... No.
This whole thing is exposing some very interesting situations happening at all of these open boards. Anybody that has to operate under Robert's rules, those are the rules that open meetings have to conform to in order for them to be legal, this, that, and the other. We're finding out that a lot of these people on these boards, they may be adjacent to those rules, but they're finding that they don't fully understand them.
And they're definitely not following them.
And therefore, they can't be following them. And that's leading to more issues. And again, it's all about the law. And again, some of these positions are volunteer. The majority of them have some sort of compensation that comes along. Now, not great amounts of compensation by any means. But these are people that choose to take these positions, county commissioners, city council persons, any of that kind of stuff, school board. They choose to take these positions. Now, these people that are in these positions now may not like how things are going, and they should resign. If you're not comfortable having to answer questions and you're now putting time limits on public comment sections, there's something wrong with the free speech section of this whole argument.
And that brings up a whole other issue, because I know personally, and I know you and I have talked about this, I, as a Gaylord alumni, and you as well, I'm frankly disappointed in a lot of school board members that we elected I mean, I would have expected more from all these people.
You know, I wish I knew more about that. So my mother was a school board member for a very long time. I don't know enough about what goes on there, other than I know some pretty damn important decisions are made.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for a long time, by and large, these particular organizations, school boards, have gotten away with, you know, either a lot of anonymity with these decisions and or a lot of sort of behind the scenes dealings where they're just passing budgets through, amendments to certain things, what they're teaching, what they're not teaching, what they should be teaching.
With nobody intervening.
I think a lot of people are starting to kind of wake up to that. And, you know, that's probably something we'll talk about further as we keep these conversations going. But we want to wrap it up here before we get going too much longer here. So special edition of Bye Feliza.
April 29th. Bye-bye.
Yep, bye-bye. We'll accept your resignation. We'll be looking forward to see who comes next.
Hey. You can always apply at the Iron Pig.
That's right. We do have a dishwasher position open. Mm-hmm. Anyways, thanks for joining us as always. Murphy Law Podcast. On behalf of Chris Kuhn, I'm Ian Murphy. Thanks for joining us as always.